I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Why are you here this time?
I told you, somebody's what? Trying to kill me.
Oh, Jesus. Somehow I don't think I should be looking at this.
Just look.
What? Oh, come on, I looked at this now. I was blue in the face 3 years ago.
Since the assassination, six of these people have died in some kind of an accident.
Four. Look, nobody's trying to kill you, huh?
These people were killed. And whoever killed them is going to try to kill me. Austin Tucker thinks so, too. Austin thinks that maybe we all saw something up there.
Yeah, well, we did see something up there, didn't we?
No, I mean something else.
Well, what do you mean by something else? Does he ever indicated what he means by that? Has he ever indicated to you that he saw anything other than what was in the commission report?
No.
Nothing? No. Did you see anything up there? Well, neither did I. And believe me, I looked. We all looked.
You mean if you didn't see it, it's not there?
Well, I didn't say that. It's just that I know all about these accidents. Ralph Scoletta was a known lush. He hit a piling on the George Washington Bridge. He killed three other people with him. Joy Holder died of anaphylactic shock when the doctor gave her the wrong antibiotic. Herbert Moon burned himself up in bed smoking, which his girlfriend always told him he was going to do, and Harry Lutz had a heart attack.
Harry Lutz was 40 years old. It's too young to have a heart attack.
No, it's not.
He was thin. He was in terrific
shit.
Condition.
He found out his wife was banging her psychiatrist, and on the same day, a bulldozer accidentally knocked over half his house. Come on, he was lucky to last that long. That's future shock, Lee.
You mean you no longer believe that there was another assassin involved in shooting Carol?
That's right. But it was an explanation. People were crazy for any kind of explanation then.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. It's the concluding edition of our Parallax Views on the Parallax View retrospective, and to cap off this special, we have someone who was directly involved in the film, namely John Borsten, who acted as an intern assistant to Alan J. Pakula, the director of this classic paranoid thriller. Borsten also directed the Academy Award-nominated documentary short The Exploratorium in 1974 and was an associate producer for Pakula's follow-up film to The Parallax View, the final entry in his paranoia trilogy, All the President's Men. Additionally, Borsten is the author of such books as Mabel and Me, a novel about the movies, and Making Movies Work, Thinking Like a Filmmaker. In this conversation, John and I discuss the Parallax View's cinematographer, Gordon Willis, the point that director Alan J. Pakula was trying to get across with this film, the significance of this classic thriller in light of the January 6th riots, comparing and contrasting the Parallax View to All the President's Men, and much, much more. And now, on to the third part of our Parallax Views on the Parallax View retrospective special with our very special guest, John Borsten. Welcome to Parallax Views, John Borsten, who actually got to work on the movie that this show is named after, The Parallax View. How are you doing, John?
I'm fine, thanks.
So, John, for my listeners that may be unfamiliar, what is the movie, The Parallax View, from 1974, and how did you get involved with it?
Well, first, let me just give a little background about myself. I ended up, after that, working with Alan Pakula, the director, as his associate producer on All the President's Men, and I wrote a script that he also directed and worked in that as a producer. But this movie that we're talking about was the very first film that I ever was involved with as a feature film. I was taken on as AFI intern for $50 a week to basically watch how they did it. And that was, you can imagine, a kind of life-changing experience. So I was sort of Alan Pakula's assistant, but basically at the beginning, I was just sort of watching and trying to learn what I could. And people, you know, when they're working hard, but they do a lot of standing around themselves, they don't like the sense of someone standing around watching with nothing to do. So I got kind of the cold shoulder for quite a while until Gordon Willis noticed that I was hanging out with the script supervisor, Karen Wookie, who was keeping track of everything and trying to figure out what was going on. And he kind of felt that I was caring enough that I was worth paying attention to. And he kind of folded me into the film crew. So I got involved with them a little bit. And then with Alan Pakula, as things developed and the needs changed. But it was a very strange movie to get involved with because it was very chaotic. I didn't know. I thought all these movies are made this way, but there was in the middle of a writer's strike, and the script was being rewritten from being a New York cop who discovers what's going on to a San Diego reporter. So you can imagine there's a lot of rewriting going on, and there was also a writer's strike. So there were no official writers writing, which meant there would be longers and people would sit around the set and they'd talk about the script, and then mysteriously pages might arrive. So this was all very exciting to me, but the people working on the movie found this kind of bizarre. Gordon said that he thought it was the most disorganized movie he ever worked on, and he's worked on a lot of films. So there was a sense of chaos, but also an uncertainty about what was happening, which in an odd way fed into the kind of paranoia of the movie, because that's what the movie's about. People think's happening, and no one quite knows what's going on. They would have stopped. Pakula wouldn't have made the movie except that Warren Beatty was on pay or play, which meant that they had to pay him whether they made the movie or not. And he wouldn't take a month off and let them write the script. So they had to write it while they were shooting it. And as it turned out, you know, these things have a way of sort of finding their own truth. And in a weird way, for this particular rather crazy movie, it actually sort of worked, as you can judge for yourself when you look at the film. But what that meant from Gordon Willis's point of view was that he had to kind of figure out a way to stitch this thing together, because the script, we were literally getting scenes with X numbers for to shoot, which meant they didn't know where they went in the script. Instead of saying this is scene 22, it'll be seen this is scene 6X. But he figured out a way to give it a look which kind of unified it. Alan said that he wanted it to feel like a comic book, and big, bold colors, frontal images, strong compositions. And Gordon took that, and he realized that in order to make a movie that you can put together different ways, you had to shoot it in a way that it can be what they call a jump cut, so that instead of having people walking in and out of buildings and setting up scenes, which kind of lock you into a certain structure, he figured people would be jumping in and out of scenes in the middle. So he shot his close-ups in such a way that they kind of matched each other, used similar lens and similar angles, so that you could do that, and it visually it would not be disorienting. It could be visually satisfying, even when you were, as he said, slicing and dicing the thing. So he hated shoe leather, which is people walking around, and he was really in the service of Alan's vision. Pakula was a very, very smart guy with a lot going on in his head. As Gordon says, and there's a wonderful interview with him, by the way, in the Criterion Collection of this film, he says, Alan would walk around with his arms full of papers, you know, and then Gordon's job was to kind of take all his papers and make pictures out of them. Because it's great that they're full of all these great ideas, but it's the images that matter. And that's what this is really about. So he had a way, and he also has said that he didn't think that movies weren't real. It wasn't about capturing reality. You should feel like you're in a movie while you're watching this. And this is the man who made the Godfather movies and Annie Hall. It's a way of saying that the movie has to be kind of larger than life and have a kind of your reaction to it as an aesthetic whole on its own, rather than as a slice of reality. That was his way of doing it, and it worked very well.
And we're talking about Gordon Willis,
the cinematographer.
This is Gordon Willis, correct. And so what Gordon Willis took this and applied it, and so these movies he made with Alan, this one and All the President's Men, had a similar need, which was to had to be larger than life. That one, because it was so real, that it had to be elevated above the mundane reality of these people sitting around newsrooms, which Gordon did beautifully. This one had the opposite problem, because it was basically a fantasy, a weird myth. When you start breaking it down, it had to have a kind of a visual style that felt mythic and hyper real, so that you wouldn't be questioning the script too much, because if you do, the whole thing kind of can kind of fall apart. But what Gordon did here is make this a wonderful collection of images. And, you know, he managed to solve the problem of this movie. And I happened to be sitting around with him because he was living in his family was on the East Coast, and he was making the movie out here in the West Coast. And he didn't have a lot of people out here. And I would kind of hang out with him after shooting and sit with him and listen to him in bars and talk and stuff. So I learned a lot about what was going on that way. It was really my education in the making of movies. And he was, let me say, a wonderful man to have as a mentor.
I wanted to add something there, if I could. What's really interesting to me about how Gordon Willis tackled this film as a cinematographer is he really is able to purvey the sense of paranoia through the imagery. A lot of the shots we see of Warren Beatty's character, Joseph Frady, the reporter that has come upon this conspiracy involving the Parallax Corporation, a lot of those shots, it's almost like he's being watched. He's being surveilled in these shots. And I think you really get that sense of menace from the way Gordon Willis approached the cinematography.
That's a very good point. And let me say that was Alan's idea too, that you should feel like you were being watched the whole time this was going on. That's a good example of how the two of them work together, actually, because Alan would say something like you would say, and then Gordon would figure out a way of making you really feel it when you looked at the picture. It's hard. You have to think back also to the period when it was being made. Don't forget, we think we're in a strange time now, but there was a lot of horrible things happening. We had the assassination of JFK and his brother and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Freddie Hampton. And not only that, but the man who assassinated JFK was shot. And the man who shot the man who shot JFK was shot. And then the people reporting on it were dying in mysterious ways. So there was a lot of strange things happening that no one could understand. And there's still argument now as to how much of this was just strange coincidence and how much of it was conspiracy. You know, when Kennedy was shot, there's still, you know, people starting about this. Was it the CIA who did it even? Was it the mafia? Was it Cuba? Was it the Russians?
We also had Watergate at the time.
Yes. We were shooting during Watergate. We would watch on the set. We would watch Nixon on TV with his stack of transcripts saying, "I'm not a crook." So yeah, it was. So what the thing about Alan is he has a paranoid bent, not as a human being. He's a very straightforward guy, but he has a love of this uncertainty and confusion. I mean, the fact that we were shooting this movie in the sort of sort of chaos was something that he actually kind of flourished on. I mean, somehow it brought out the best in him. It challenged him. So, for instance, the whole movie hangs on this thing called the test sequence. The idea of the story is that the investigative reporter is trying to discovers that there's this hidden group of people trying to assassinate other people, and he tries to infiltrate the group. So how does he do that? You know, he parades as one of them. He gets a false identity, and he gets himself in. But these people he's doing this with, they're smart cookies. It's not clear what they know or don't know, but you do know you have to fool them in a way that's very convincing. So what happens is the final test he's given to see whether he will be someone that they'll hire is this thing that he goes through called the test sequence, which you can actually Google on YouTube.
But yeah, it's very reminiscent of sort of Eisenstein's approach to cinema. It's a very, you know, powerful sequence within the film.
Thank you. Yes, I think it's doubly effective when you think of how it started, because it's now this visual montage. The idea of the thing is, this is Alan's idea, the whole idea behind the movie, really. Here's this driven investigative reporter who cuts corners and does anything he needs to get the story. There's a ruthlessness about him and a lack of empathy, which is really similar to the people who are doing these political assassinations. And so there's some part of him that's very much like the mentality of these killers. And the ultimate joke of the movie, let's call it a joke, is that he takes this test and he passes it because he is potentially one of them. Not that he wants to go kill people, but he has the same drives, the same angers, the same attitude toward life of a lot of the people that they would recruit. And the point Alan is making is that, in fact, this guy is a particular character who's more that way than most of us, but we all have this in us. And what this test sequence is actually designed to do is to draw it out of us, so that I, looking at the sequence, feel that maybe I'm a killer. I could be the killer. I could, instead of making me see them as strange alien creatures, it makes me realize that I'm one of these people who could be out there killing people if things were a little different. And when you see what happened at the Capitol, you know, on January 6th, you realize there's a lot of truth in that, because a lot of those people were just ordinary people. You know, they weren't particularly strange or evil. And so the test sequence is a way of evoking these emotions in you, the viewer, as much as it is in the character. And that's really the key, I think, to the whole movie, because that gives the whole movie a kind of a weight and a credibility.
I want to add something to that really quickly, if I could. There's a really interesting scene where Joseph Frady is talking to one of these recruiters from the Parallax Corporation, and you see him getting angry and sort of acting like he thinks an assassin would, but you also wonder if he's really acting, this character, or if he really does have that sort of, you know, angry temperament to him.
That's a very good point. In fact, that's another absolutely essential scene in the movie. He was very proud of this performance, Beattie, because he thought he did capture this quality you're talking about. Because, you know, normally he's a completely charming guy. He has a little bit of a con man in him, a charming con man kind of guy. But here he was the opposite. He was this driven, intense person who could flare up over nothing. And then, so yes, that person is part of it. With one other thing about that scene, by the way, that is the agent who's talking to him, played by Walter McGinn, a wonderful actor who died soon thereafter in a car accident. Walter McGinn played the character who recruits Warren Beatty to be the assassin. He's working for the Parallax View. And originally, when Pakula was casting this part, he wanted to cast someone who looked like your standard FBI agent, you know, 6'2", like a football player, solid and upright. But then when he met Walter McGinn, he realized, wow, you know, this is much more real. This guy, this is the way the guy would talk him into it, not by being bigger and stronger than he was, but by getting into his head in a way that sort of a smaller man could, and a man with a certain milder approach, but that was very sort of invasive. And it's interesting to see that character because it's also a very good performance, and it's very, very similar to the character in this new movie, Judas and the Black Messiah, played by Jesse Plemons. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but it's about the assassin. You know, it's about a secret FBI agent who's a black guy who goes in to be an FBI agent and double crosses Freddie Hampton, who's assassinated in the movie. And he has a relationship with a mentor FBI agent, a white guy who's played by Jesse Plemons, who could be straight out of the Parallax View. The mentality and the way he speaks, you feel like, I would bet you anything, he looked at Walter McGinn's performance before he did this. And that's the thing about this movie, is it has that kind of resonance, because it the mentality of that, and that, by the way, is a wonderful movie. I recommend that to anybody who has a, can possibly see it, because you see this person, like the Frady in this, in Parallax View, getting sucked into a situation and then losing control of it and then becoming the victim because of the manipulation of people like Jesse Plemons or Walter McGinn.
I wanted to add something here if I could. One thing I find really interesting about The Parallax View is I know a lot of people look at it and say, oh, this is sort of a movie about like the Kennedy assassination. But I think it's much bigger than that. I think this is a movie that represented the worst fears many citizens had after Watergate. This feeling that, you know, maybe citizens don't have as much say in the world around them, even with our democratic processes. And I think it also reflects this fear that, you know, everything is maybe falling apart after the Kennedy years. And I think you really see that in the test sequence. It almost becomes a commentary in and of itself on America after the Kennedy years.
Well, that's a very good observation, because if you that was Bakula's thing too. It wasn't about the politics of it. If you notice, the first man who's assassinated in the movie is kind of a liberal, like the mayor of New York kind of guy. It was basically sort of modeled on him, and the killing was based on the Robert Kennedy. That you can see the same images that come up in the killing of Robert Kennedy. But the second assassination at the end is a totally different guy. He's like the cracker from, you know, he's the Republican country, country guy, who is from obviously a whole different political part of the spectrum. And so Alan was saying the Parallax View doesn't care what your politics are. They're just this organization that just does what it does and just grinds along. And that sense that everything is out of control and we're at the mercy of something like that was very much what he was trying to get. And it has a kind of resonance now. It's a different now, though, because now with Facebook and all the social media stuff, you kind of know, you don't have the sense of this vague, anonymous person. You have the sense of this hive of people swarming all over you. So, but it comes from the same root.
If I could as well, you mentioned that Alan Pakula wasn't a paranoid person, maybe in his day-to-day life, but it sounds like he did have an interest in paranoia as a device within the cinematic medium. And I think we see that all throughout the cinematic medium, even going back to Hitchcock or even before film with, Shakespeare plays, right? I mean, there's all kinds of sort of plotting and backstabbing, in those Shakespearean stories. We have movies like Network that were made around the same time that have sort of these conspiratorial elements. And of course, at that time, you also have films like Orson Welles' F is for Fake, dealing with the topic of deception as a theme. Do you think that filmmakers may be drawn to these subjects of paranoia and deception for a specific reason, or do you have any thoughts on that? I know that's a maybe out of left field question, but I've always been interested in that.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I mean, what drives a movie? You know, why do you people want to see a movie? The basic the simplest way is, you know, someone wants something, will they get it? Some director said that. And that's basically what you're watching. But then, of course, there are all the complications on that. Do they really want it? And do they get it? Or And when they get it, is it good or bad? And what the paranoia is this nameless dread, is a sense of fear of that's larger than what you're afraid of. And that's a very compulsive thing to get sucked into. And of course, that's what a good suspense movie or a good horror movie can play into very well. And Alan Pakula was very good at building those moments, which is very different. I mean, he wasn't as much of a master at action scenes, for instance, as Gordon Willis said, you know, you don't give him a saddle or a gun. you give him something that a bomb under the table, you know, that might go off at any moment. And then he can play a whole scene where you're getting incredibly scared, but you're not seeing anything but a cocktail napkin. Like in the movie, in the Parallax View, where someone puts a bomb on the plane, and we have to try to see whether the plane, you know, whether Warren Beatty can get the plane on the ground before the bomb blows up. And it's a masterpiece of this kind of paranoia, of playing on your fears through his fears. You know, you're watching movies, you're experienced through the characters, and you feel what they're feeling, but you're also judging what they're feeling. It's a kind of a dance between what you're feeling and what the character's feeling, which kind of makes the movie go, you know, gives you energy.
Now, immediately after the Parallax View, Alan Pakula completes the trilogy, started with Clute, what people have called the political paranoia trilogy. This is the second film in that trilogy, The Parallax View. He then completes the cycle with All the President's Men. And I think it's interesting. I think there's a lot of compare and contrast you can do between All the President's Men and The Parallax View. I think in a way, The Parallax View may represent a director like Pakula's worst fears about where our country was headed at the time in light of Watergate and matters like that. Whereas All the President's Men, I think, represents the hopes for reform and maybe change and journalists changing the game. Whereas in The Parallax View, Joseph Frady, the journalist, ends up not necessarily being the hero. He's sort of the mouse being pursued by the cat.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that way, because when Alan makes a movie, he often doesn't know how it's going to end. This is a weird thing. Like when he made The Parallax View, he didn't know that the test sequence would be. That was just a big hole in the movie. And we also didn't know how we'd go out on Warren Beatty at the end. So, and All the President's Men was a case which was even more extreme, because you got this story here, which really ends 2 years after the movie's over, when the guy finally resigns. Don't forget, this is at the beginning of all the Watergate stuff. So what happens is, I was working on that with him, and you know, they were writing the script, and I was suggesting there's a moment in the book where the two characters, Woodward and Bernstein, betray, like in The Parallax View, they betray their trust, because they're trying to find out what's going on with the grand jury, and they find out the names of some people on the grand jury, and it is against the rules, it's probably illegal to talk to the people on the grand jury and see what they're saying, but they do it anyway because they want to know. And they approach a person on the grand jury, and the grand jury person talks to the judge. And then the judge calls all the journalists together, okay? And the judge knows that it was who it was, because the woman told him. And the scene is not in the movie. But what the judge is, this is where the judge holds their future in his hands. Basically, they have betrayed their trust by doing this, and the judge could destroy their career by announcing, telling them, but doesn't say it. He just says, someone has done this. This is inexcusable. It cannot happen again. And then all the reporters leave, and the reporters are all go out talking to each other, trying to figure out who was the person who did this terrible thing. And there are Woodward and Bernstein among all the reporters. And Woodward and Bernstein, of course, have to sort of pretend to be speculating with them. And then people ask Woodward and Bernstein, when they did it, did they do it? And of course, Woodward and Bernstein say, no, us? Who, us? No, of course not. Which is what in the movie is called a non-denial denial. Okay, because that's what they accuse the Nixon people of doing all along, these non-denial denials, where they'd say no, but it's not really no, and they really mean yes. And I thought this would be a great way to end the movie because it would show essentially, like in the Parallax View, that the people are the same. The good guys and the bad guys really have the same are humanly the same in the base. Well, that worked for the Parallax View, but I got completely slammed for suggesting that on All the President's Men, because that, you know, as it was very clear, that wasn't what this movie was about. This movie was about, as you say, the triumph of hope, you know, that these guys are good guys and that there is a future. And the way they ended All the President's Men was they have this terrible setback based on a misunderstanding and they think they're ruined, but they decide to keep going anyway. And it has them going back to the newspapers, typing away, and over the typewriter, there's a montage of images, which I helped shoot with Gordon Willis, of the teletype printing out the results of the next 6 months or whatever it is. I forget how long. And finally, on video of the president accepting his nomination and all of this stuff. So essentially, we feel that, yes, they were at the bottom, but they didn't stop fighting. You know, the last dialogue scene is the Jason Robards saying, you just got to keep going, you know. Nothing's riding on this but the Constitution and the future of the United States. And does that sound familiar from January 6th? Anyway, so that is a very good point, that is a difference about them that I hadn't considered.
I guess before we close out here too, I'm curious, I've found a lot of people are now rediscovering the Parallax View, even a lot of younger people. And I think younger people look at it and it's sort of maybe they see in it a reflection of their own cynicism about various institutions today, whether they're corporate or government. You know, I think a lot more people will say, oh yeah, JFK, it was all a conspiracy. But what's interesting about the film is I don't think it takes a very cynical view of our institutions. I think it's rather horrified at the possibility of institutional corruption, whereas I think a lot of younger people today almost take this really disturbing view of, oh yeah, there's corrupt institutions and we can't do anything about it. Whereas the film we're talking about, The Parallax View, there's a real sense of horror in this movie. It almost plays like a horror movie in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Is there hope or not? I mean, it is a fable and it's bigger than life. And if you really start questioning exactly what's happening every moment, you know what Hitchcock called refrigerator logic? Did you hear that phrase? He says, what happens is when you see one of his wonderful suspense movies, you've had a great time and then you wake up in the middle of the night and you go to get yourself a glass of milk. And as you pour yourself a glass of milk, you're asking yourself, why didn't they just call the police? And he says, that is refrigerator logic, which you think of in the middle of the night when you open and get your glass of milk. And he said, if you apply that kind of logic to this movie, you would find, like with Hitchcock movies, that there are certain holes in it that probably would make it not hold up. But the thing is a fantasy anyway. What it's proposing is so bizarre and outrageous that you have to accept it on its own level, which is what Gordon Willis was saying, is this is a movie. You have to accept the reality of the movie and buy into the ad experience that you're having, which means you have to give it a certain look, cast it a certain way, write it a certain way, so that everything adds up to a feeling, which is completely different than the feeling of All the President's Men, made by the same people, who, because that one was based devotedly on reality. The dialogue was really what people said. The scenes were, that was exactly the place where they did it. But it still had that higher specialized quality of being a movie in a different way.
And I also feel like The Parallax View, when you really get down to the base of it, beyond dealing with paranoia, this is, as you sort of point out when talking about the Joseph Frady character and the sort of monsters within him, this is almost a movie about how any of us can become or have within us the monstrous.
Yes. Yes, the idea that he's the hero, we're rooting for him. And don't forget, he was the hero of a lot of movies at that time, too. He was one of the people who was America's hero. That at the same time, when he's shot at the end, everyone can prove he did it, you know. And what makes Alan a really good director is that wasn't like a fake trick that they can prove he did it. We watching, because we've seen the test sequence, say, well, you know, they're kind of right. I mean, he didn't actually pull the trigger, but there was something about him that there's some truth in that, you know, which is, you know, what people say, what I say when I think about Trump and what he does or doesn't do. You know, it's everything is, and this is where Alan's brilliance as a portrayer of paranoia is, because he accepts the contradictions. Just one last thing, I'll go back to Clute, the first of these paranoid movies, which Jane Fonda was in, which she won her Oscar for, playing a call girl who people are trying to murder, but who has a compulsion to seduce people, and it gets her in trouble. But she's trying to break the habit, and I suggest you look at that movie too, also shot by Gordon. She's trying to break her call girl habits and reform herself. But what Alan said is what makes it interesting is that she likes seduction. She's driven to do it. She has a compulsion in her to seduce people. And that's what makes her an interesting character. The same thing that you kind of look down on when you think about her as being, oh, she's just a hooker. She likes to seduce people. There's an element to that feeling, that I'm wanting to seduce people, which we all have. We're always seducing people all the time, and which she has so acutely, and she can portray so viscerally that she can win an Oscar.
I think that shows the genius of Alan Pakula, because he's able to portray that within all of us. We have both the better angels of our nature and also the ability to be corrupted, to become monstrous. In closing, though, I really wanted your thoughts on the Parallax View. When it initially came out, there were some negative reviews from various figures at places like the New York Times and Time Magazine. Since then, it has basically been accepted as a classic, hence this new Blu-ray release on the Criterion Collection. Why do you think there's been a change in how this film is viewed today as opposed to when it came out? Was it just very ahead of its time? Because it had mixed reviews initially, and now it's considered a true classic of 70s cinema.
Well, that's a good question, and it points to one of the things about movies. You know, there are a lot of books when they're written. The Great Gatsby, one of my very favorite novels, perhaps the greatest American novel, when it came out, it didn't sell any books. It sold as many books in the whole lifetime of Fitzgerald as it now sells in 1 year, okay? And the reviewers, there was one reviewer who said it was brilliant, but nobody else did. But the truth of the book was there and it was discovered. That's very hard to do with movies, because movies have a release, they're out, and then they disappear, particularly things before video existed. I mean, the movie came and then it's gone. And right after that movie, another movie came out that was extremely popular. It was about a similar kind of scene, it was Chinatown. And Chinatown just kind of wiped this one off the map. Just because that's what happens with movies, and because it was a very good movie, and in some ways, you know, a stronger movie than this one. In ways that critics appreciate. So that movie, but now, in retrospect, you know, without taking anything away from Chinatown at all, which is a wonderful movie, this had a reality about it which caught something in the times, which we now realize it kind of spoke for something in all of us, because it was simple, because it was slightly confused, because it was irrational. The things that the critics took it to task for ultimately turned out in a weird way to be kind of assets.
I was going to add to that. I think one of the greatest assets to this film and why it may have turned people off was it really absorbs you in this sense of menace and paranoia. It's very unrelenting, just the imagery, the soundtrack. You really become absorbed in this very menacing world, and you sort of adopt the paranoia of the characters in the film yourself.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think of, you know, All the President's Men came out. It was nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture, and the one that won that year was Rocky. Okay, Rocky's a perfectly fine film, which is the film people are talking about now, you know? And that's not uncommon at all with Oscars. That's just sort of the way it works. But that's one of the frustrating things and one of the delights of movies. There's always some wonderful movie you don't know about that you discover and it turns out to be magnificent.
Well, I would say that's really true with the Parallax View. This is a film that I think everyone should see. I think it's a powerhouse of a film, and I think it has an extreme emotional resonance, even at this very moment in this age where I think there's been a lot of disruption with the Trump presidency. I think people can really relate to it. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the Parallax View or anything you can tell us about the recent Blu-ray release by the Criterion Collection?
Well, Gordon Willis was off, I think, shooting The Godfather when they were doing the color correction timing for this film originally. You know, it was shot on film with Technicolor process. And so I supervised the post-production, the final look of the answer print, because Gordon wasn't there. He asked me to help to do it for him. And so they asked me to help them with this print here, because when they were making the Criterion, they didn't have a good guide. For various reasons, stuff wasn't available. So, but I must say, they've done a terrific job capturing the original feeling of that movie, which I helped them get, but they managed to start with original camera negative. And so it looks really the way Gordon Willis intended it. And and there's also some very interviews, particularly with Willis, but also with Alan Pakula, worth listening to if you like that stuff.
And I was going to say, I think there's also a new introduction by Alex Cox, who has written about the Kennedy assassination and has also directed great films like Repo Man. So there's a lot to recommend with this Criterion Collection release, and I think it does this film justice it truly deserves.
Well, good. I'm glad you liked it, and I hope people check it out.
Well, thank you again, John Boorstin, for coming on Parallax Views.
Well, good to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for our Parallax Views on the Parallax View Retrospective. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with Joseph McBride, Alex Cox, and John Boorstin. It was a pleasure to have all three on. It was a pleasure to speak with Boorstin about his actual involvement in this classic thriller. If you haven't yet, please consider checking out the Criterion Collection release of Alan J. Pakula's The Parallax View. Trust me, it is more than worth the watch. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.